The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I've been getting these daily emails with suttas. So every day a sutta or a sutta excerpt comes in the mail. It's called Reading Faithfully. You can find it at readingfaithfully.org if you're interested in that. And a few days ago, this sutta came in from the Anguttara Nikaya, number 5.114. And this sutta is about the Buddha telling Ananda, his assistant and cousin, five things in which new monastics should be encouraged, exhorted, and established. And I thought, oh, these are kind of nice five things. These are kind of like also applicable to us, maybe as lay practitioners. At least most of it. Even, you know, for experienced people, they're very interesting. So I'll go over them from the sutta directly, but I first just want to name them real quickly so you have an overview of what those five are. And the first one is virtue, or sila in the Pali language. The second one is guarding the sense doors and mindfulness. The third one is to watch one's speech. The fourth one is dwelling in the wilderness. And the fifth one is right view or wise view. And today I'll be using Tanisaro Bhikkhu's translation of this sutta. So the sutta goes, the first little part goes, on one occasion, the Blessed One was staying among the Magadhans at Andakavinda. Then Venerable Ananda went to him, and having bowed down to him, said to one side, as he was sitting there, the Blessed One said to him, Ananda, new monks, those who have not long gone forth, who are newcomers in this Dhamma and discipline, should be encouraged, exhorted, and established in these five things. Which five? And then the first one is, come friends, be virtuous. Dwell restrained in accordance with the Patimokkha. The Patimokkha is the basic code of monastic discipline, and it consists of 227 rules for fully ordained monks and 311 for fully ordained nuns. luckily, we don't have to follow all of those. But, so he says, dwell restrained in accordance with the Patimokkha, consummate in your behavior and sphere of activity. Train yourselves, having undertaken the training rules, seeing danger in the slightest faults. Thus, they should be encouraged, exhorted, and established in restraint in accordance with the Patimokkha, those rules. And so for lay people, the Buddha also has some quote-unquote rules. They're called precepts or training rules. They're not like the Ten Commandments or anything. It's more like something that we can practice with and try to adhere to as much as we can. But if we for some reason don't adhere to these rules or trainings, then it's not the end of the world. We can just reinstate our intention. So I think I've talked about them before, but I'll just name them real quickly. The first training rule is the training rule of abstaining from taking life. The second one is about abstaining from taking what is not given. Third one is abstaining from sexual misconduct. The fourth one is abstaining from false speech. And the fifth one is abstaining from fermented and distilled intoxicants, which are the basis for heedlessness. So alcohol, basically. And And these training rules form the basics of our Buddhist practice. And the Buddha would often not start teaching anyone meditation before they had some teaching in this basic virtue, or sila in Pali. And then another basic would be dana, generosity. So dana and sila are together with meditation the basics of our practice. So it's not surprising that the Buddha here says to these new monks, like, oh, it's important to adhere to sila, to virtue. And then you might wonder, like, why? Why would it be? One reason that the Buddha names in the suttas is that if we adhere to these training rules, if we manage to not harm any beings, basically, because that is kind of what it comes down to, right? Not harming. So he says, by abstaining from the destruction of life, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, from liquor, wine, and intoxicants, which are the basis for heedlessness, the noble disciple gives an immeasurable number of beings freedom from fear, enmity, and affliction. He himself, in turn enjoys immeasurable freedom from fear, enmity, and affliction. So we become this safe haven for other beings if we follow these training rules. They're like the basis for a wholesome life. And the Buddha also says that the purpose and benefit of wholesome virtuous behavior is non-regret. So if we don't do anything that harms other beings or ourselves, then we don't have anything to regret. And this can be really beautiful to reflect on for ourselves. And if we practice with these training rules for a while, and we manage to somehow, like, at least have a pure intention of following them, even though it might not always work out, but then we know, okay, well, I did my best, and I don't have to regret this. And I have to regret anything in my life. And so this is about leading a wholesome life, a life of non-regret, of non-harming. And even if you're not convinced yet that that's a good thing, then you could maybe investigate for yourself the difference in what is it like to act and speak from a wholesome place, from a place that encourages happiness, encourages care, encourages kindness. What is that like? And what is it like to act and speak from unwholesomeness, from a place that is divisive or harmful, that doesn't contribute to happiness but to more suffering? What does that feel like in your body, in your mind? What does it actually feel like to harm others or yourself? It usually doesn't feel that good, right? Even if you feel justified. And then we can also look at, how does it feel to be harmed? What if others harm you, or they lie to you, or they inflict some sort of harm? What does that feel like? That doesn't feel good, right? So, and the Buddha also says, this is a direct quote from the suttas, what is displeasing and disagreeable to me is displeasing and disagreeable to the other too. How can I inflict upon another what is displeasing and disagreeable to me? It also reminds me of Christianity a little bit. So if we don't want anything to have done unto ourselves, then maybe we shouldn't do that to another, right? The Buddha also points out that wholesomeness leads to more wholesomeness and happiness, and unwholesomeness leads to more unwholesomeness and happiness in our lives. It's also literally in the suttas, in the Dhammapada, which is a collection of verses from the Buddha that is attributed to the Buddha. It says, if with pure intent you speak or act, then happiness follows like a shadow that never leaves. If with corrupt intent you speak or act, suffering follows you like a wheel, the ox's foot. So that's a little bit about virtue. I can talk longer about this, but I'll go to the next point that the Buddha made here in this encouragement to the new monks and nuns. So he says, come friends, dwell with your sense faculties guarded, with mindfulness as your protector, with mindfulness as your chief, with your intellect self-protected, endowed with awareness, endowed with unawareness, protected by mindfulness. Thus they should be encouraged, exhorted, and established in restraint of the senses. So restraint of the senses, or guarding the sense doors, is something that the Buddha would regularly advise. And sometimes it's being understood as that, for example, restraining the sense doors is just literally not looking up, for example. There's this example, I forgot which monk it was, one of the Thai forest monks who for a whole rainy season, which is like this 3-month period in the rainy season in the summer, for us in the summer, for those of us in the northern hemisphere. For the whole rainy season, he made this commitment not to look up at beautiful women that he might encounter. And so he did that. So that's kind of a form of restraining the sense or restraining the sight so that he wouldn't be, nothing would be sparked by seeing these beautiful women. It has kind of its limitations though, because after those 3 months, this monk started looking up again and he noticed that lust was still present and didn't go away during those 3 months. So it is kind of a temporary solution, but it can help. I noticed that if I have, you know, certain types of food in house, certain snacks that I really like, then it's, you know, more likely that I actually eat them than if I just don't buy them, because then I have to go all the way to the store. So that's also a form of restraining the senses. So, you know, we could use this form of restraining the senses in many different ways. Like also, for example, if we know that we watch too much television, then we could, you know, let someone hide our remote control. Or, you know, if we just don't turn on music that we know will just keep listening, even though we want to do other things, you know, then we can make sure that we don't turn on the music. That kind of thing. But what I was alluding to in the meditation, there's another way of restraining the sense doors, which is that we look at the sense doors, we look at all this sense data that comes in. So what I was saying in the meditation, there's a sound contacting the ear door, and let's say it's a bird, and we go off on this like wanting and craving for more bird song, or like, oh, why does this bird stop? I want more. that kind of thing. And then guarding the sense doors would mean that we notice right away, there's a sound happening, and let's not go into any craving or pushing away. If it's a leaf blower, not the pushing away of the sound, but to stop there. And this is not always possible, of course. That's something that is sometimes possible. It's definitely worthwhile trying. We can also pay attention to this immediate response that we always have, this response of Vedana, Vedana being feeling tone. So it's not like our normal kind of feelings as we normally speak about them, like happiness or sadness, etc. It's feeling tone is about the immediate liking or disliking, or neither liking or disliking of something that happens. Like that sound again, if it's the sound of a bird, there's immediate liking, or the sound of the leaf blower, immediate disliking. It's automatic. We can't help it. It just happens. And then what often happens, so if we look at this, liking and disliking can be really useful, because what often immediately happens is the craving or desire right away when there's liking, or the aversion or pushing away when there's disliking. So paying attention to this can be really helpful. Like, oh yeah, there's an immediate response of wanting, or an immediate response of not wanting. So that could be an entrance to guard the sense doors, to look at the contact moment and the immediacy of the liking, disliking, or the neutralness of it. The neutralness often goes into like delusion or ignorance, the not knowing, the spacing out kind of quality of mind. Yeah, also this is a very rich area that I could talk more about, but I'll go on to the third point that the Buddha makes here for the new monks and nuns. He says, come friends, speak only a little. Place limits on your conversation. Thus they should be encouraged, exhorted, established in limited conversation. So speak only a little. Limit your conversation. Speech is so important in our lives. We use it so much, you know, not only just our regular kind of like talking that we do physically with our mouth, but also in text messages or emails or on social media. All that is also speech in a way. So it's important to use our speech wisely. And you can imagine for beginning monastics, when you start practicing intensively, you know, it's better not to speak too much. Like maybe some of you have been on a retreat, been in noble silence, and you know how powerful that can be to not speak for a while, even if it's just like a day-long retreat. Just not speaking for a day can be really powerful in helping our practice go forward. But even not on a retreat, in our daily lives, it can be really important to watch our speech and see how are we using our speech. Are we using it wisely? Wise speech is like one of the vectors of the Eightfold Path, the path towards freedom. For example, we might be, you know, speaking too much, like the Buddha says, like don't speak too much. Especially if the speech is not really contributing to anything, like if it's kind of gossiping or in another way, not, you know, super useful. And the Buddha also says that some of the ways that we can use wise speech is to only speak when it's beneficial or when it's at the right time and when it's kind. And especially not to engage in idle chatter. So speech is a super rich area to explore in our lives. And we can also look here through the lens of wholesome versus unwholesome. Is our speech wholesome? Does it contribute to more wisdom, more happiness, more freedom? Or does it contribute to unwholesomeness, harmfulness maybe even? Now, if we're really angry, we might be saying things that might harm others. So it's really important to look at that. And then let me move on to the fourth point. Come, friends, dwell in the wilderness. Resort to remote wilderness and forest dwellings. Thus they should be encouraged, exhorted, and established in physical seclusion. So here again, for these new monastics, that can be really useful to be in a secluded place. But I want to point out the wilderness part, the nature part. Because the Buddha recommends that in other suttas as well, to be in nature, to sit under a tree, to sit in the wilderness. And there might be various reasons for this encouragement. Yeah, maybe it's just practical that there weren't that many dwellings back then, not many monasteries. And yeah, it might be just the place to go if you want to be in seclusion. And maybe it had to do with overcoming certain fears that might happen. Like in back in the day there in India, there were all these tigers and other dangerous creatures. Venomous snakes and whatnot. But on the other hand, nature can bring us so much delight and so much relaxation as well. Especially in our relatively safe nature, if we go out on a hike in a park or something, it might not be too dangerous. Of course, there are always some dangers, but it's not that we have to look behind every tree to see if there's a tiger or something. So in our modern day, there's so much benefit from being outdoors, being in nature. Science has done so much research around it. Stress reduction, relaxation, awe, inspiration, health benefits that we get from it. And so we don't have to be monastics to practice outside. And we can practice in our yard, or even just a balcony, or in front of a houseplant even. Or we can go out to a nature park and do some sitting or a walking meditation there. Especially in our modern day lives, like, nature can really help us to disconnect from our busyness, from our devices, from the pace of our modern life. And then if we, you know, especially if we leave our phones off or are alone in nature, it can be so restorative. And there's so many lessons to learn from nature. It's so such a inspiration. Lessons like the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta, which means impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. Impermanence is so present in nature. Everything changes all the time. And dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness, there's nothing to control there. We can't, you know, it is just going to be, in a way, unsatisfactory. It's always, since it's always changing, we can't really rely on it. And then the not-self aspect, it's just happening. Nature is just happening. Nature has so much equanimity. And nature doesn't get upset. The trees, the rivers, the plants, the oceans. You know, they just equanimously endure whatever is happening. Endure the sunshine, the rain, the wind, the storms. So we can see that as a metaphor for our practice. Can we be like nature? Can we endure both the sunshine and the storm? And then the fifth point that the Buddha makes for the new monastics. He says, come friends, develop right view, be endowed with right vision. Thus they should be encouraged, exhorted, and established in right vision. Not just like a right view or wise view, or right speech, wise speech. Also, here we see that this is one of the path factors, the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's the first one. And the Buddha says, I do not see even a single thing on account of which unarisen wholesome qualities arise and arisen wholesome qualities increase and expand so much as right view. So, you know, if we want to cultivate this wholesomeness, then this right view, or as I like to call it, wise view, can be really helpful. It's also very much interwoven with the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. All these path factors work together and strengthen each other, but wise view is in every path factor present. So we need to have some right view or wise view in every step of the path. And so what is wise view, right? This might be good to address. So there's two types. There's mundane wise view and supramundane wise view. And mundane wise view is about understanding what leads to wholesomeness and what leads to unwholesomeness. So it's this understanding like, maybe this thought sequence is not so wholesome. It leads to unwholesomeness, or this action is not so wholesome, or this action or speech is very wholesome. Just understanding this basic tendency of the wholesome versus unwholesome mind. And then the supramundane wise view is about the Four Noble Truths, seeing the suffering and the end of suffering clearly. So the understanding of the Four Noble Truths deeply is the same as having wise view on the supramundane level. And so back to the mundane right view or wise view, Joseph Goldstein in his book Mindfulness refers to this mundane right view as giving us worldly ease. And I think that's really cool. It points to how, when we practice with this mundane right view, we can experience this worldly ease. And then the supramundane wise view will take us beyond this worldly ease. But just practicing for some worldly ease is already so beneficial and helpful. It can help our lives to the next level. So and often when we come to meditate, we are looking for some ease, right? Some happiness. Most people come to practice with some dukkha, some suffering or unsatisfactoriness in their lives. And they are looking for a bit more ease, a bit more happiness. So this wise view can help us with that, seeing what is wholesome, seeing what is unwholesome. So yeah, I could probably give many Dharma talks on each of these these points, but I'll end here for today. And the Buddha, so just to recap, the Buddha advises us to cultivate virtue, sila in Pali, guard the senses, and be mindful, to watch our speech, to dwell in nature, and to cultivate wise view. I want to end with a quote from Lama Rod Owens. If we don't do our work, we become work for other people. So all these 5 points hopefully help us to do our work.